everybody's saying that, I just thought it would be a really nice idea to see if we could recapture the time we sang that song, because it was for me anyway, it was a unique experience going through learning that song, and particularly that song, because it's, you know, one of the best known protest songs in the world, really. And I think Anthony, you called it a demand, and that's exactly what it was. And getting the spirit of that song was just amazing, and doing it in this hall was equally amazing. And I felt something tangible then when we were recording it, and I felt it like you could actually touch it, you could collect it, and harness it. It was just a gorgeous feeling. I don't think that happens very often. I think probably it's a fairly unique thing, but I think singing encourages it, and that sort of singing deep. And also the way that Ellie and Anthony arranged it, and with all of the little bits like we did the warm-up, the free bits, you know, and being able to insert those words into interviews about what is a really difficult subject. I felt that other people in the room felt that too. So that's all really that I want to say. I'd just love to see if we could recapture that and get what other people felt from doing that. Because it brought something really special. So anybody else that wants to talk about it or to add, I'd love to get that recorded, but also maybe send it to people that work here and people that have that affiliation here.
So you were going to record tonight, weren't you?
I am.
You're recording it.
Yeah.
Can I just be quick? Just finding a way to torch, actually. I said to Sue when I drove home after when we did the rehearsals, I don't think it was the actual take, but I don't know, it was just this absolute joy in that singing, but I think it was in this place as well. And it did to me just resonate with the history of the place. And people have mentioned Paul Robes and singing here, but when I was doing work on the Workers' Memorial, contacting people who were associated with the people who were honoured on the Port Adelaide Workers' Memorial, I remembered Ron Giffard, who was secretary of the Seamen's Union, and the Seamen's Union and the Wharfies used to be based in this hall, and that building just outside there, he built when he was state secretary of the Seamen's Union, which is just across the... They moved out of the hall to their own owned premises, which are now flats, those buildings there. And his widow has been assisting us with sharing information. And I've got this folder, which is from Ben Gibbard, and this is a telex that was sent to this building, would have come to Gibbard. On the 22nd of June 1972, and it actually says in the back, telephonic advice from Bull, that's Taz Bull, federal organiser, WWF, that's Waterside Works Federation, Sydney, to Giffard, South Australian branch secretary of Seamen's Union of Australia. And this is a page and a half, and I just wonder whether I'd read that.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Because I guess, we hear about the activism of the unions around apartheid, but what I found really powerful with this was a very clear of the industrial aspect of seeing apartheid as an industrial issue and why they would connect with that. So it says, it's about a ship called South Ocean Adelaide. Four ships jointly owned by South African Maritime Corporation, and in brackets the South African government, Royal Inter-Ocean Line, two Dutch and two South African flags, All four have Dutch officers, black South African seamen, brackets Bantus. When Ted Bull, Melbourne Secretary of WWF, went aboard the South Ocean Adelaide in Melbourne a few days ago, was told by the skipper of the ship the conditions of the crew were none of his business. Wolfie stopped two ships in Melbourne. Joe Van Middelkoop, director of South Ocean, flew to Sydney last week to discuss with maritime unions the problems regarding South Ocean vessels trading to this country. It emerged that from that conference, that meeting, that the hold-up to the satisfactory solution of the problem was in fact the apartheid policies of the South African government on three bases. Bantus, blacks, were not allowed to be in trade unions, i.e. as a result of the amendment made to the South African Labour Laws 1956. The name of the law is Industrial Conciliation Act, amended 1954 and again in 1956. Two, Bantu are not allowed to be in any mixed-race organisation. On the second ground, they cannot be in the international, the ITF, the International Transport Federation. If they came under the ITF agreement, they would be entitled to a wage increase of about 200%. This would disrupt the whole wage structure of South Africa and the use of slave labour. The Rand Daily Mail, Johannesburg, 5th of June 1972, gives an example of the mining industry where white miners, 360 rands per month. Cape Coloureds receive 75 rands per month. Asians receive 98 per month. Bantu receive 18. Banks and building societies of the community white get 298 per month, African 66. That is the nearest comparison to white. Conference today between maritime unions and the owners' representatives was cancelled by the South African ship owners' representatives. They having taken the view that it is our intention to extend the dispute to other ships of the company, and then it names three of those: South Ocean, Amsterdam, Auckland and Albany. Telephonic advice from Tasbord.
That's amazing, what a find.
Yeah. So I remember that, I guess, when we were singing too.
That's incredible information that very few people know.
Yeah.
People don't know.
The seamen union did a lot of work, a lot of that sort of work, didn't they? They were very strong in those early days in the 70s, you know, fighting for the rights of their workers. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, my great-grandpa, Jorgen Singer, he sailed ships. He's from Denmark. And my great-grandma, we went to Denmark and met him, and then they had my man. And he used to come here, and my dad's got all his union tickets and all that stamped and everything. So that's many years ago. And he played a squeeze box, and he used to play the squeeze box here in the Naval Academy, I think, with his two mates. One had a snare drum, one had a big bass, and I've got his squeeze box at home. Yeah. And I've got his picture. And he made a ship, one of the ships he sailed on, out of sticks and stuff, and put it in a bottle, and it was at the Alvin Hotel. So he used to run amok. He'd go to the Naval Academy here, the Naval Academy, then go to the Alberton Hotel and run a real muck to the back of the Alberton Hotel. So he used to climb under the tunnels at the hotels over there, one of the corner. It's closed now. My aunt used to work there. Yeah, right. So a bit of history there too. Wow. And to do like our time here, we've bombed over the years, different facilitators have taught us different songs, and they taught us two South African songs. I can't remember who they were, but the Paradisi and the Zenzi South African songs as well. Yeah.
Well, I just thought the night that we did the singing, there was a lot of, to me, it all kind of worked, because we're a community choir, all the communities of Singapore, and this place was a community activist group, and working together and showing what can we achieve when people work together in the union movement. And then what happened with Nelson Mandela was it took the whole world's collective action to work together. It took a long time, but it was an example of collective action. And I just felt there was a bit of synchronicity there of us singing in this hall about that song. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me personally was, because I lived through all that, it wasn't something that, you know, we lived through Nelson Mandela being in jail, and we knew about it and we heard about it and we knew about apartheid then. And, you know, and there were some, of course, and I think in a way that sort of started a lot of the issue or discussion about what happened in Australia with Indigenous people too, so it was... Mm-hmm. It wasn't that we could just say, well, it's all over there. We knew that there was issues here as well.
And they're ongoing.
Yeah, ongoing. But anyway, I just thought singing in here was a perfect place to sing.
Mm-hmm. Could I just mention or ask Sue?
Yes.
Just putting her on the spot.
Yes.
But actually in this folder, you might have opened the look of it, just the history of, because Sue worked in the union movement in South Africa. I'm just wondering what you have in it.
It's such a big story. It's kind of like where do I start? But just to start in the space of, for me, it's kind of tracing those continuities of the stories and the voices and the sounds that have been heard in the space. And I kind of wonder where those sounds go. And you know, they seeped into the plaster on the wall and into the curtains and into the floorboards. They kind of still feel imprisoned. You know, whether it was Paul Robeson or the war visit in the 1928 strike or, you know, your great-granddad and your family story and the Scottish rocks. You know, all of that somehow still resonates in the space. And they bring it more current to us all singing the Nelson Mandela. You know, it's kind of, I just love those tracings and those continuities of, mm-hmm. of story and history. Julie, I don't know. I was an organiser and mechanical workers in the Industrial Union in South Africa. And initially, trade unions were banned in South Africa, and unions were organised in a segregated along racial lines. So I was a white woman organising mainly black, poor black industrial workers. And that in itself was quite an amazing experience to have. So it feels kind of so present for me, but so far away as well. Remember once we had a strike at a rubber company, and we occupied the factory, and we finally evicted. They brought high pressure hoses and evicted us, but we stayed in the workers' kind of effectively their change rooms in the factory. And I look back on it now, and I think, a white woman on my own with probably about 800 men, workers, and I never once felt afraid. It was just a remarkable kind of experience of comradeship and trust, and just random things are popping into my mind and memories. But yeah, so unions were banned for a long time, so a lot of our work was kind of underground, setting up various associations called the burial societies, where people would come together and put in money each month to support families who had funerals to pay for. So that was the front, was that it was a burial society, but it was a way of organising and mobilising and bringing people together. And then over time, those kind of coalesced into more formal organisations of workers, and then when trade unions were unbanned, they kind of came surfaced a lot. There's lots to talk about.
I should have shared this file with you earlier, but there is also some magazines from the Seamen's Union, and there are accounts of just sailors who have got off in South Africa and are just observing daily life. And one of them saw an accident where a white guy in a car knocked a black man off his bike and just, you know, and he was injured. And this guy went to support the black man, and just that experience and the reaction of the police or whatever. You know, they're writing about it and how that even politicised, you know, just looking at him. So just interesting, I guess.
Mm. And I think that those individual observing and interactions like that. But I think also that there's that incredible sense of international solidarity. So, you know, when we were in South Africa kind of in that struggle, a lot of us weren't oblivious to the fact that, you know, people in Australia, in the Waterside Workers Hall, were kind of taking action and kind of acting in solidarity. We were kind of just in the midst of it all there. So it's kind of only when you step back from it and you realise all the linkages and the whole anti-apartheid movement all around the world. I mean, we were aware of it, but media was so kind of shut down that there's very little reporting about international solidarity action. But yeah, again, it's those tracings across the world, you know. Capitalism is a global system, and so, you know, our response to it through international solidarity is again kind of global response.
Mm. One of my favourite stories about that is the Glasgow City Council was known as a very left wing council, and they the South African embassy building in Glasgow was in St George's Square, and so one night they just resolved that St George's Square was now going to be named Nelson Mandela Square. So that meant the South African Embassy had to have on their letterhead, South African Embassy, Nelson Mandela Square, Glasgow. They hated it, and they eventually sold the building and moved somewhere else because they couldn't bear to have it on their letterhead. And when he was released, Glasgow was one of the first places he went, and he wrote in the book, you know, that was the best thing. For the cost of some new signage, it really pissed off the whole South African government, apparently. So it's still called Nelson Mandela Square in the middle of Glasgow, by the way.
Was there a sense, Sue, in South Africa, or an awareness? I mean, I guess there, in many ways, there probably wasn't here as well, but around, like, history or where some of those laws or policies, so, you know, bear such closeness by design to what was happening here in Australia. Was there any sense of...
Absolutely. I mean, the White Australia policy.
Yeah.
We all learned, you know, that the power blocks learn from each other and share tips on how to be really honest. You know, so White Australia policy replicated in South Africa.
Is that part of public awareness, though? Like, but did you know about the White Australia policy?
Not in the 80s and
90s. Yeah.
It's only from coming here that put it together. But, you know, and in the same way as, you know, Britain's learning from Australia about how they handle asylum.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's that kind of power bond that shares ways of control, you know, social control.
Mm.
People's
movements. When we were singing that song, and just because it was here, it was really wonderful, because I actually worked with asylum seekers, quite a lot of them, and what I thought is that what we should be doing is say free those people that are still in Papua New Guinea. Now they've taken them off of the island, but they're back in Papua New Guinea and stuck there, you know. And no one's saying anything about it. Mm. It really does annoy me that we're not jumping up and down and saying it's unfair. We've got to get them to Australia. You know, I expected that when Labor government got in that maybe we would change that. And I know that some of them have come to Australia and they've gone to New Zealand. But there's still about 80 people, I believe, stuck in Papua New Guinea, not wanting to be there. So that just resonated for me when we sang that song. I love coming back to Port Adelaide. I was brought up basically here. Used to be our drinking place, you know. So, and this place in particular, Terry's. My father-in-law used to, you know, come here and have all of these meetings for the waterside workers. So it sort of, this place resonates, and the songs we sing resonates for me. It's really lovely. Mm. Mm.
That's powerful for me, because we were thinking of lots of freedom. So I remember lots of things. It's like the apartheid movement was coming into being, because I left an island which was very beautiful, but very, very isolated, kind of back into the world. In a sense where I had some more personal agency and freedom myself to pursue a different life. To the life that I knew, which was not, it was a good life, but it didn't involve thinking in those ways. And in fact, to me, it was very, as what happens, I empower processes. Somewhat shut down around silence when all the cultural silences were there. So I had to come somewhere else to explore. But I wanted to know more. But, and, you know, again, we were talking about, you know, what's gone on, taking our process to the UK around silencing, you know, around silencing, part of the cutting off PNG from Australia is just to create silence, which is existing around aspects of PNG. Insofar as there's no one to refer to, because even the council officials, a couple of council were the only people who tried to work with refugees. PNG, it's a beautiful grassroots story. They formed their own refugee and vulnerable migrants committee. And it is just a committee of ordinary people who were one day Catholic bishops, and that was their only kind of role in life. They knew that that was a thing called pastoral care. And they were forced into becoming their own human rights organisation and talking to people like the UNHCR. But it's not what they had no experience. And they have no one to speak to, because Australia will not speak to anyone in PNG, and no one on behalf of anybody can make contact with Australia. And even though we know that it's completely false that they actually speak, it is really quite a powerful instrument of silencing. But yeah, that just kind of way we share models. Which is why, whenever we speak, anyway, whenever we speak, we're breaking silences.
Did you want to say something?
There was a time when people talking about the anti-apartheid movement, like it suddenly was there and they hadn't noticed before. And I've been around a long time. And when the Springboks came to Adelaide to play, my husband was playing rugby for North Adelaide. And I went to the match to see what was going on. And some of the North Adelaide players ran onto the field to disrupt the game, and they did. Four police chased after them, caught up with them and arrested them. But it was a little bit of a victory as well, because they disrupted the game. Because the South African team were all white, there wasn't a black African amongst them, and it was just so obvious that it was apartheid and racism. Of course, now sometimes you find someone at a football match that runs across the oval stark naked, but people think that's okay.
What are they protesting?
When these guys did that, there would have been people thinking, yeah, you know why they're doing that, and others would have thought that was just a bit of fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was much deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that the resistance to the spring boat, when Mandela was released, the first thing, well, not the first thing, but he went to, I think, the first, you know, the story, see, the first kind of big rugby match, the Springboks on the Pro Jays were playing, and he put on the Springbok jersey, just as a kind of act of defiance, of going, this is not our jersey, it's not the kind of a jersey, it's kind of symbolic.
Mm.